More than a million Americans suffer from lumbar spinal stenosis, a common cause of lower back and leg pain. In fact, it's the most common reason for back surgery in people age 60 and over. But today, right here in central New York, doctors are studying an effective and relatively easy way to relieve people of this debilitating pain. Joining us this morning to tell us more about it is Dr. Richard Tallarico, assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery and chief of spine surgery at Upstate Medical University. He's also a graduate of Upstate Medical College. Dr. Richard Tallarico, welcome.
Good morning, Linda.
Tell us first, let's start out, what is lumbar spinal stenosis? Help us understand that.
Lumbar spinal stenosis is a condition in which there is crowding of the spinal canal in the lower lumbar spine, which is typically associated with degenerative process, degeneration of the disc, as well as degeneration of the joints in a form of arthritis of the spine, can crowd the spinal canal where the nerve roots travel. These are the lumbar nerve roots which travel through the lumbar spine and eventually exit the lumbar spine and enter into our legs.
So it can cause all kinds of problems. What are some of the problems that it causes?
So typically the symptoms that are associated with spinal stenosis are grouped under a term called neurogenic claudications. And what happens with neurogenic claudications is that patients typically suffer from back pain, pain radiating into their buttocks and down their legs after periods of prolonged standing or walking.
Okay, so is this something that just occurs with aging, and is it a common occurrence with aging, or is it just some people? I mean, who ends up with this?
It's extremely common. It's the most common problem that we treat in patients over the age of 60. It affects both men and women. It is a process in which degeneration, which is part of the aging process, but can also be related to injury or things along those lines, cause a relative change in the spine, which leads to the crowding of these nerves.
Can it also happen is it a hereditary phenomenon that some people just are born with more narrow spinal columns? Or
well, in more rare cases, there is something called congenital lumbar spinal stenosis, which typically affects patients with abnormal anatomies. We see it in achondroplastic dwarves and other patients in which the spinal canal developed in a way that's not accommodating for the nerve roots.
So most often it's in people as a result of aging, 60 and
most
over.
Most often it's a result of degeneration, which unfortunately is seen in our aging population commonly.
Does it tend to run in families, though? I mean, is there a predisposition within
there
families?
There is a hereditary component to most spinal conditions. It's a multifactorial process that occurs related to some possibly genetic predisposition as well as acquired factors, such as intensive labor or past injuries or things along those lines that could accelerate the process.
So your occupation could play a role, the kind of work you do.
It could play a role. The thought process is, though, that if each of us live long enough, we'll eventually develop lumbar spinal stenosis.
Really? So it really is a factor of aging, I mean, basically.
That is true.
So how disabling can it be to people, and how would you know if you had it?
It can be extremely disabling. We tend to talk in terms of functionality. So we tend to describe symptoms in a functionally disabling way. And that gives us an idea of how much of a problem it is for patients. The functionality portion of it is that it really limits patients' ability to stand and walk for long distances. And that's a very important function in everyday life. Some patients are debilitated to the point where they can't stand for more than a minute or so and need to sit. Sitting in classic lumbar spinal stenosis typically relieves symptoms or at least improves them.
Why is that?
The reason is when we stand upright or walk standing upright, we tend to close down the spinal canal even more. Mm. So there's a relative closing down and it makes the pinch on the nerves even more extreme. When we flex at the waist, such as seen in a sitting posture, we open up the spinal canal ever so slightly, and that often will relieve some of the symptoms. So typically, patients with spinal stenosis will be extremely comfortable seated, but can't stand or ambulate for long periods of time. And that can vary from anywhere from patients with high activity levels that say, geez, doc, after a mile or so, I really need to sit, to others that say, I can't make it to the mailbox.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really variable. And of course, you know, we try to treat patients dependent on the degree of dysfunction. There are some patients we'll see with asymptomatic spinal stenosis.
In other words, how would you have picked it up then?
Well, occasionally they're referred a routine x-ray or a routine MRI that shows spinal stenosis. And after discussing the symptoms with the patient, they really have very few. It's really very, you know, minimal with regards to the limitations or impact on their life. And those patients don't require any treatment. It's important to understand that we're not treating radiographic findings, we're treating people. And if you don't have symptoms, spinal stenosis does not necessarily need to be treated.
So talking about the radiographic findings, what are the kinds of technology that you use to help determine this?
Well, you know, aside from our basic history and physical exam, which, you know, besides the technologies, is really the hallmark of making the diagnosis. Most often I can make a diagnosis of spinal stenosis after a simple conversation with the patient, because they describe classic symptoms, which include pain radiating into their buttocks and legs, as already mentioned, that gets relief when they're seated or stooped forward. One of the classic signs for spinal stenosis is what we call the shopping cart sign, which is that patients will say that they can walk through the grocery store leaning on a cart indefinitely, but without the cart, they can't stand upright on their own, and they have a hard time. There are other classic symptoms, such as difficulty standing after waking in the morning and things along those lines. The examination usually doesn't point to much except for the fact that patients will not tolerate standing or extending their spine for very long, and sometimes lying flat is a major issue. There can be neurologic problems, but fortunately, it's pretty rare in spinal stenosis. With regards to the imaging...
Well, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, because sure, we're going to have to take a quick break now. But when we come back, we'll talk a lot more about the imaging and all the other wonderful breakthroughs that you're involved in right now.
That sounds great, Linda.
Okay, I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio, 106.9 and 570 WSYR. To HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with surgeon Dr. Richard Tallarico, and we're talking about lumbar spinal stenosis. And right before the break, we were talking about how you determine when someone has spinal stenosis in terms of the radiographic studies. What kinds of techniques do you use?
We start with basic imaging in the form of plain x-rays. One of the most important x-rays is actually a dynamic test in which a patient flexes and then extends their lumbar spine, and we take pictures at the extremes of both motions. That's important because often it will show instability. One of the common processes that is seen in association with lumbar spinal stenosis is something called spondylolisthesis, which is slippage of the vertebra, most commonly seen in women between the ages of 50 and 70. And typically when we see this spondylolisthesis, it's usually associated with stenosis. Aside from that, CT studies can be useful in showing narrowing of the spinal canal and relative arthritis of the joints. But the gold standard for diagnosis is typically an MRI, mm-hmm, in which we see narrowing of the spinal canal, crowded nerve roots, okay, broad-based disc bulges, among other things.
But you said this motion test is also important because then you can actually see positional changes having an effect.
CT and MRI and plain x-rays are static tests.
Right.
You take an x-ray in one position. The dynamic testing with the flexion extension really shows us what happens in time.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Well, what non-surgical treatments, I mean, you are a surgeon, clearly that's your expertise, but what non-surgical treatments have been helpful for people?
Well, the mainstay of treatment for spinal stenosis is non-operative treatment. Typically involves anti-inflammatory treatment. This process of spinal stenosis has a component of inflammation. Typically the nerves are inflamed. Anti-inflammatory treatments can be really useful. In patients with more severe symptoms or acute flare-ups, steroids can often be useful, usually prescribed in the form of a Medrol dose pack. Mm-hmm. This in combination with physical therapies and sometimes activity restrictions, such as activities that are provoke symptoms. So if patients like to run or things like that and don't realize that that's actually aggravating their symptoms, we'll give them a period of rest from those activities. But at no point is bed rest a part of this treatment.
Mm-hmm.
For patients who fail those conservative measures, the next line of treatment would typically be in the form of epidural steroid injections.
So those nerve block injections to kind of block the pain.
Yeah, more classically known as nerve blocks, these epidural steroid injections are direct dosages of steroid placed on the irritated nerves, which again have an anti-inflammatory effect and often will alleviate symptoms.
Right. There have been obviously surgical treatments that have been going on, you know, all along. What are the more conventional ones? Because we're going to get to the more kind of interesting ones and the new ones that you're experimental ones that you've been involved with. But what's the typical stuff that's been done historically?
Once a patient has failed conservative treatment and their problem is disabling enough, we look towards surgery as a solution. The mainstay of surgery and a classic procedure for spinal stenosis would be in the form of a lumbar decompression. Decompression is a broad term or an umbrella term that describes freeing up the nerve roots. The nerves are compressed, we decompress them. That usually involves a combination of laminectomies, foraminotomies, procedures in which we remove the offending structures that are pinching the nerves.
So you actually get in there and you cut parts of the spinal column.
We cut part of the back of the spinal canal away. And that's a laminectomy, removing the lamina. And then we undercut what we call the facets and then clear out the nerves in the tunnels that they exit in, called the foramen, and that would be called the foraminotomy.
Okay.
But again, a better term is a decompression, which means we'll remove whatever we need to remove to free up the nerves so that they're no longer under pressure.
Sometimes do you also fuse parts of the spinal column together?
So in certain scenarios, fusion is important, particularly in one that we just discussed, spondylolisthesis or slippage of the vertebra.
Because it's unstable and you're making it stable.
So if there's instability, you need to stabilize that segment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes decompression and laminectomies can further that instability. So in that situation, we use fusion. The original way to fuse was simply with bone graft. More modern ways include spinal instrumentation, such as screws and rods, and that's become a convention for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you're here today to tell us, though, about a new treatment that you've been working on for how long? I mean, how long have you been involved? It's an emerging treatment.
Sure. It's a new technology. We've been involved over the last year and a half. It involves interspinous spacers. An interspinous spacer is a procedure in which we do not formally decompress the nerves. We do an indirect decompression, which means we try to mimic patients' spinal canal dimensions in a flex position. So as I mentioned earlier, patients gain relief when they're flexed forward. So what we do is we flex the spine and we put a wedge, if you will, or a spacer in between the bony prominences of the lumbar spine called the spinous processes. And this holds the spine in a relatively flexed position in that one segment where the nerves are pinched. It allows patients to stand upright without pinching that area. It is, as you mentioned, an emerging technology. The original device that was implanted was called an X-stop and has been relatively successful in its implementation.
How long has that been ongoing? I mean, when did the X-stop come into use?
X-stop has been around roughly around 10 years. It has longer track record in Europe. Right now it shows tremendous promise with regards to the fact that patients are getting seeing good relief of their symptoms, and it's a minimally invasive procedure that doesn't carry as much risk as some of the more conventional procedures. More recently, we looked at a newer device, which is percutaneous. So a smaller skin incision done directly through the skin, even relatively easier to recover from and easier to implant. And that's a Superion device made by a company, Vertiflex. And our most recent study is in association with the FDA. It's called an Investigational Device Exemption Study, known as an IDE, in which investigators selected by the FDA are able to implant these devices and compare their effectiveness versus the X-stop.
So you have, is it a double blind or is it a randomization?
It is a controlled randomized trial, which is basically one-to-one. So patients are randomized either to X-stop or to the Vertiflex device. And we follow those patients with outcome measures. So patients' feelings and perception of their pain, how much pain relief they had.
How quickly they recover.
Exactly. So, and we compare the two devices.
So, first of all, how long has this been going on? And is it going on in many centers?
The study is a national study. It's a multi-center study. We are one of the sites, and I'm the principal investigator, and I have my three partners, Dr. Lavelle, Sun, and Madame, are co-investigators. And we've been involved for the last year and a half, and we've been enrolling patients with very good results thus far. And it's really opened up an opportunity for us to look at this device as an intermediary device between injections and more conventional surgeries. And what we're finding out is that patients are actually doing quite well and very pleased with the fact that this is done in an outpatient-type format with very little blood loss, very little risk, and patients are getting back to work faster and back to their lives faster.
So how have you found so far that it compares to that other, the X-Stop?
X-Stop. I think the devices are very similar with regards to their outcome. They're performing in a very similar way. Right now, the advantage seems to be that the Superion device can be implanted with somewhat greater ease.
Help us understand a little bit. When you say percutaneous and through the skin, how is that different? Is the X-Box placed the same way?
X-Stop is still considered minimally invasive, but it requires a longer incision because it's placed from the side. So we need to cut down along the spinous process, remove some muscle off the spinous process, and then go from the side. Whereas the Superion device is implanted directly from the back through a very minimal skin incision, roughly 4-5 millimeters.
Mm-hmm. So how, at this point, you're feeling that will it be the long-term fix? Is it curative of these kinds of problems? Or is it the kind of thing where it's just going to hold you for some time before you might have to have further surgery?
Well, I'm smiling because curative is not really a word we use in spine surgery in general. I wish we could reverse the degenerative process and make this like it never happened. We're treating symptoms, and for some patients, they'll get complete relief, but never do we assume we have the capabilities of providing a cure. As far as the long-term results, we don't know. That's why it's in a study, and we'll follow these patients out many, many years, and hopefully we'll find out that this is a device that would provide long-term benefits. Results from Europe are promising with regards to that. But here in the States, we don't have long enough follow-up to really understand the longevity of the device.
So they've been using this X-Stop and this now Superion spacer in Europe for a longer
time. X-Stop has been used in Europe for quite some time. I do not know exactly how long a Superion device has been used over there.
But overall, do patients get, in both cases, do they get relief immediately? I mean, how long does it take before you know that
you've... That varies. Some patients notice immediate relief the first time they stand. They no longer feel the quote-unquote pinching or the pain down into their legs. Others take some time. Usually, within the first 6 weeks, you notice a result. More patients leaning towards early results, you know, within the first few days to week.
So, but the recuperative period for this new device seems to be shorter, and there's less blood loss, as you said, so somebody could basically start back to their normal activities on a more rapid basis?
That is true, especially compared to conventional surgeries, mm-hmm. which take a fair amount of time to recover. Compared to a lumbar decompression infusion, the hospital stay would be typically, you know, reduced by 4 or 5 days, and patients would be back on their feet immediately and returning to work in at least a third of the time.
Well, Dr. Richard Tallarico, assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery and the chief of spinal surgery, this is very, very hopeful news. Thank you so much for coming in today and telling us all about it. We have to take a short break. I'm Linda Cohen, but there's more HealthLink ahead. This is FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.